You're listening to Motherlands, an Asian Heritage Month special programming show on CITR 101.9 FM, brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm Isa. CITR 101.9 FM broadcasts from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. We have a packed show for you today, including an overview of the Chung Collection at UBC, Zi Wente's project, A Family's History of Malaysia, and last but not least, Adeline Pang's interview with Leticia Sanchez, president of Vancouver Asian Heritage Month Society, as well as Jing Palad, member of the board of directors, who is also in charge of the Interconnected Project. But first off, we're starting with a little background history of Asian Heritage Month. In 2002, the Government of Canada officially declared May as Asian Heritage Month. The U.S. had been recognizing the Pacific Asian American Heritage Week since 1978, which was extended to Pacific Asian American Heritage Month in 1992. It was only until 2001 that the first motion to recognize Asian Canadians was proposed by Vivian Poy, who was also the first Asian senator. People in Vancouver had already celebrated Asian Heritage Month, although it had not been officially recognized at that point in time. So here at CITR, we really wanted to continue and follow this tradition of recognizing Asian Canadian histories and achievement. So our first story is local. In the basement of the IKB library at UBC sits an impressive collection of artifacts and records of the Chinese diaspora. The Chung Collection is on permanent display at UBC. I was given a tour before the pandemic, and you can hear the awe in my voice. Let's take a listen. So do you mind, first of all, like pronouncing your name?
My name is Christina Laszlo, and I am the archivist here at Rare Books and Special Collections at the UBC Library, and I'm the person responsible for the Chung Collection.
What is the Chung Collection, first of all?
Of course. Okay, so the Chung Collection was donated to us about 20 years ago by Dr. Wallace Chung and his wife Madeline Chung. And Dr. Chung, Wallace Chung, had been collecting since he was actually a small child. So this is about 60 or so years of collecting. And he became very interested in the Canadian Pacific Railway Company. His mother had come over from China on the Empress of Asia. And he had grown up looking at a poster of this ship in his father's tailor shop in Victoria, and he was always fascinated by the Canadian Pacific Railway and the ships that brought people across the ocean to Canada. So he started collecting, and then eventually his collecting branched out to also cover not just the Canadian Pacific Railway Company, but early exploration in British Columbia, and also immigration and settlement, and particularly immigration and settlement of the Chinese diaspora.
So do you mind, you know, giving me a tour?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to give you a tour of the collection. It's a really amazing collection. So what you see here on exhibit is actually just a small portion of the entire thing. Most of it is available for research and consultation in the reference room, and there's an online website students can go to and researchers can go to look up all the material that we have available, and it's huge. There's something like 25,000 items in the collection, and which includes archival materials, photographs, ledgers, documents, as well as rare books, and all about the exploration of British Columbia, the archives and papers of prominent individuals in the Chinese community who helped build Vancouver, helped build British Columbia, information about the railway company, the gold rush, and also maps of early explorers to this part of the world, dating all the way back to the late 1700s. So we have maps from some of those early Spanish explorers as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot here. So we usually start the tour with basically just explaining how Dr. Chung started collecting. So this photograph here, I mean, you can't see it if you're listening to me talk, but there's a photograph at the very start of the exhibit that shows Dr. Chung's father's and in his tailor shop. And over in the top corner, you see the ship that inspired Dr. Chung. So he grew up looking at this poster. So it's a really nice way to start the exhibit because it really shows it really shows what the inspiration for Dr. Chung. And he also really wanted to collect this material partly because of his own roots, but at the time that he started collecting Canadian Pacific Railway Company materials, it wasn't as popular of a collection, so he really was able to acquire a lot of materials that would be much difficult to find nowadays. Also, he was interested in documenting his roots and the roots of his community, so a lot of the materials that he has on the Chinese community in BC and in Canada, again, would be difficult to find now because they're more people are now interested in collecting that type of material, but when Dr. Chung was looking at it, it was easier to find, and he was able to collect a really, really cohesive and detailed story about the Chinese community in Vancouver and how this community helped to build this province and their role in the New World, as much as, if not more important, than the role of Europeans in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm. So personally, I'm really interested in the Chinese-Canadian aspect of it, just because I am like Chinese-Canadian. Mm-hmm. And so if we're walking through, if you could point out like the specific things that really highlight the Chinese-Canadian like artifacts or whatnot, or like the experience, that'd be great. Thank
definitely.
You.
So I'm not sure where to start, but certainly I think the early days of the first Chinese that came to this part of the world was probably as part of the Gold Rush. And they set up businesses to help not only to support the gold rush, but also participate in it as well. So we have things like this gold pan that I think Dr. Chung, I'm not sure where he found this. If you're lucky enough to have him give a tour of this collection, he has stories for most of these objects. But the gold rush is really where it started, and then moved on to the railway company. As most people that have studied Canadian history know, or British Columbia history, that getting the railway to connect the eastern part of Canada with the west coast was one of the conditions of Confederation for British Columbia to enter into the Confederation of Canada, and the only way that they could meet this deadline was to hire labor from Chinese labor that they would pay less and worked under very harsh conditions, and many people were physically injured or lost their lives as part of this process. So there's a lot of material here that tells that story of Chinese labor on the Canadian Pacific Railway and how that railway would not have been completed without that help. So if we go over to the section that has a small bit on the railway, which is here. So this exhibit case really highlights how dangerous the work was to build the railway, especially through British Columbia, which has many mountain ranges. So there was lots of blasting that needed to be done. And finally, the last spike of the railway was done in Kirgalaki, which is in the Rocky Mountains, I believe. And it's interesting, so you see this photograph on display here, which shows the last spike of the railway being hammered in. And what's interesting about this photo is who's not in the picture. So you see what you see here is a lot of European men in suits, probably all the railway bigwigs who are here, who really did not do much labor. Mm-hmm. What you don't see in the photo is any person of Chinese cultural background, which is interesting because without them, the railway would not have been built. So it's interesting how people revise history to leave out a lot of contribution. So this collection is also really important in that it brings that contribution and that history back into the foreground rather than it being ignored in what would in the past would have been a common story of the triumph of business and getting this railway done and completed in time for Confederation. And in the past, glossing over the contribution of Chinese labor to getting that done. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect here. And I can show you my favorite, my absolute favorite photo in this collection is this on the wall here. So what we're looking at is a photograph of the Chinese Students Football Club of Vancouver, and they won the 1926 Iroquois Cup. So by football here, I mean soccer. So this is the soccer team. And what I really love about this story is that the soccer or football teams in Vancouver at that time in the 1920s were not integrated. So the Chinese players were not allowed or discouraged from playing on the teams of players from European descent, but they were so good that they won the Iroquois Cup, which was an intercity cup at that point in time. So this photograph shows the football team with the cup, and what I love about this is that they triumphed again in the face of racism and in the face of exclusion, that they came back and beat the other teams. And it's a really great photo. It sort of covers it's about, oh, I don't know, about 2 feet by 3 feet wide. It's a great photograph, and it shows the team in all their glory. So I really like this one, not just because I'm a football fan, but because I love the story of them beating the other people at their own game.
Yeah, it's like, even though I've lived in Vancouver mm-hmm. for a long time, I haven't really been able to see like a lot of evidence of the Chinese contribution. Yeah. And so like it's nice to have this collection here.
Well, that's exactly it, because it, you know, in building and talking about the history of British Columbia and talking about the history of Vancouver and the history of Canada, it's important that all the contribution of all the different communities that helped build this province is included in the historical narrative. And in the past, that narrative has been, I don't know if controlled is the right word, but definitely the dominant view has been the European view, one of conquering the land, of creating opportunity in business, and it hasn't included the contribution of all of the other communities that have also participated in building this province, and not just the Chinese community, but the South Asian community and all the other communities that have come to this this part of the world looking to build a new life, just as the European people were here looking to build a new life. And that desire and that dream isn't exclusive to one community. It's something that we all share. Most of us are immigrants to this land, whether it's Europeans, and we're all settlers here for the most part. So everybody's story is relevant and important, and this collection definitely does a lot to help bring the Chinese part of the story to the foreground.
Okay. Anywhere else?
Well, this case here is talking about the Yip Sang family, who was a prominent family in Chinatown. So it just shows that people were here and they were successful in business and they were building communities. So this display case shows beautiful china and flatware and silverware from one of the Empress ships that was on the route between Hong Kong, China, and the Pacific Coast and Vancouver. And what's interesting about this is when you look at it, you just see china and plates and dishes and things and menus. But what's interesting about this is how Dr. Chung, how the plates specifically came to be in this collection. So the story goes that the people who worked on the ship, especially in the kitchen, were largely Chinese labor again. And on going back and forth, at the end of the shift, if people were tired, it was a long shift, that the dishes would come back, and rather than washing them, people would throw them overboard. So the idea here is that, or what I've been told once, that if you were to drain the Pacific Ocean, you would find a trail of CPR china from Vancouver to Hong Kong because of all the things that had been thrown overboard. So many of these plates were actually brought up from the bottom of the ocean by divers who found them. And at first they were wondering, they thought they were just broken crockery and things, but as they started pulling them out, they realized that they were full plates. So Dr. Chung acquired, I think, 30 or 40 plates from this diver who had brought them all up from the ocean floor as part of this. So it's a great story, especially just because it's like, you can imagine at the end of a long shift and washing dishes, you're just, you know, I don't want to have to wash this. So overboard they went. But it's also interesting because on those Empress of Asia ships, it was, you know, Chinese labor who worked on the ships, but it's also a lot of people moving back and forth between Hong Kong, China, and Vancouver in terms of getting to this new world. As I mentioned at the start, Dr. Chung's mother came on one of the the Empress of Asia ships. So it was a real, the CPR was really important in that story of movement between Asia and North America, because most of those communities came across the Pacific Ocean, whereas all the Europeans came across the Atlantic. So the idea of the Pacific as a place of the Trans-Pacific story is just as important as the Trans-Atlantic stories as well.
Earlier, we walked past a display case with immigration papers. I was wondering, is there anything related to the head tax there?
Yes. Yeah, we do have a number of head tax certificates in the collection as well. Some of them are on display, and I'm just trying to think where they are in this collection, but there's a lot of material on the head tax and also the move for compensation for the head tax and issues around that as well. So when you come to the collection, you'll see drawers everywhere, and you can pull out the drawers to get more material. So it's easy to, you can spend 10 minutes here, you could spend a couple of hours here if you wanted to read everything.
So do you mind talking a bit on the certificate?
Yeah, so as part of the collection, part of the story that's documented in the collection is the head tax. I mean, there's one head tax on display, but there's others also available in the collection itself, which you can view in the reference room. And the collection itself charts the story of the head tax, the repeal of the head tax, the Exclusion Act, and all of the historic steps that happened to the Chinese community in trying to bring their families here to join them, because after the railway construction completed, there were a lot of people that stayed in the province but weren't able to bring their families out here, or weren't able to bring wives or brides or children out here because of the head tax. So that story, again, is told in this collection as well.
So I have a limited understanding of, like, this specific part of history, but I understand that this was intentional. The head tax was obviously, like, implemented because of racism.
Yeah.
And, I think it's interesting. This is just a statement, I suppose. I think it's interesting how they want Chinese labor, but not necessarily for the Chinese to, you know, be able to, like, bring their families over or make, like, a good life for themselves. It's more just about extracting labor.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it. And also, I'm not sure what people thought would happen to all the people that, all the Chinese labor that came after. I suppose they were hoping that they would go back to China. When you look at the history of the head tax as well, you see that the sum to be paid keeps increasing over time. Now, there were exemptions, some exemptions for business. Businessmen were able to bring their families out with greater ease. But for the most part, there were a lot of families that were separated with the Pacific in between them because of this, the inability or the extreme difficulty of bringing people from China over to Vancouver to join their husbands or their sons or their uncles or brothers as well. And you look at the cost of the head tax, I think it went up to as high as $500 and possibly more. And you think of $500 in today's dollars is a significant amount. You can imagine how prohibitive it was for someone who was a laborer who was probably, if they could find work, was getting paid less than European labor, to raise that kind of money to bring their family members out. It was probably close to impossible, if not very difficult. People would have to go into debt to do it, if it was possible to do it. So it really broke families apart to do this. Also, I think with the completion of the railway, you had a lot of men who couldn't find work. So I think that's how a lot of the Chinese benevolent societies started up, is to provide a way to care for and look after all of these men who did not have work or were trying to find work and to support them in some way.
Mm-hmm. And I also understand, correct me if I'm wrong, but also the laborers, when they were being collected from China, I think they were given the false impression that they would be paid better than they were. They would, like, there was just a lot of, like, false information around that, and, like, it was intentional. Do you know more about that?
Unfortunately, I don't know too much about that part of the story. I wouldn't doubt it to be true, but I can imagine. I think there was a lot of misinformation that was given out, not just to the Chinese community, but to any immigrant community, especially when they're talking about labor and exploitation. I think when you get into labor versus management or labor versus business owners. You know, there's always going to be mistruths presented and incorrect information. I mean, just look at that in any context, let alone when you add racism into the picture as well, then you're going to get all of those problems exacerbated to a greater extent.
Mm-hmm. I'm also interested in learning more about the Chinese community, like after the completion of the Canadian Pacific Railway, and how Chinese communities sprung up and how like they built a life.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of information in the Chung collection about early Chinatowns and Chinese communities, and some information about the businesses that built up and prominent business people that were part of that community. So that story is told as well, and how those communities built and how they thrived and the successes they had and the challenges they faced. So that story is very much prominent in the collection as well. The Vancouver Chinatown, just I think because we're in the city of Vancouver, is well represented as well. The businesses, one of the things that Dr. Chung was able to get from the Wing Sang Company is all of the records of the CPR purchases of people traveling back and forth to between Vancouver and China. So you get ticket stubs and who bought tickets and where, which has been a great source of genealogical information for a lot of people in Vancouver, because they're able to see their family that traveled back and forth between China and Vancouver and get a lot of information there. It also shows, I think, the thriving community, how it kept getting bigger, there's more success, and certainly with the franchise in the late 1940s and the repeal of the Exclusion Act, that those communities were able to thrive and prosper.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome back to Motherlands, the 2020 Asian Heritage Month programming at CITR 101.9 FM, made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. We decided to name the show Motherlands in part because we wanted to explore the relationships people have with the land. A home means different things for different people. Plenty of us have ancestral lands that we have not and will probably never visit. Others have had to go through the difficult process of starting a new life in a foreign country. For those of us who have not been back, our understanding of the quote-unquote motherland is very much tied to the stories told by our parents. These stories are powerful because they often end up shaping our identities in relation to our heritage. The next piece is Zee Wen Tis, A Family's History of Malaysia. They talk about their Zupu, which is a record of their family's lineage dating back to the 1800s. They also touch upon some major events in Malaysian history and how they've affected the Te family. Enjoy.
Growing up, I remember my dad kept a chest beside his desk. It was only as a teenager that I found out what its contents were. It contained three editions of my family's clan lineage book, also known as, excuse my pronunciation, Zu Bu, in Chinese from 1885, 1941, and 2011. It was gladly pointed out to me that my name was in the 2011 edition. These records were revised and reprinted every third generation by the eldest person in the extended family. My family's book has been recorded since 886 CE, over 1,100 years of family history right in my childhood home back in Malaysia. Over the years, I've been lucky enough to know where my family came from and the stories that led to me being born in Malaysia. It is through the stories my family would tell me that I feel connected to my Chinese heritage and my Malaysian nationality. I find that not enough stories get told about the parts of Asia that people over here don't know enough about. Every time I talk about my background, people will often get confused. Assumptions like I'm from China or that I'm mixed. Often I find people don't understand that Malaysia is an immensely diverse country with an equally rich history. In celebration of Asian Heritage Month over at CITR, I thought I'd take the time to retell some of my family stories, so you can both understand my personal history more and subsequently the history of my homeland, Malaysia. My name is Ziwen, and this is the story of my family. The earliest records of my clan lineage book go all the way back to 886 CE during the Tang Dynasty. Our family's earliest known ancestor was a general named Ke Yuan, who hailed from the Guan and Shou states, now known as the Henan province. At this time, the central plains of China were suffering from constant civil wars, and the warlords had to seek for new territories that further down south. Ke Yuan led a team of armed men, together with their family members, to attack Min, now known as the Fujian province. Once they succeeded in their attack, Ke Yuan and his men settled down in Min and retired on a piece of land named Yongchun County, which is also my ancestral village. By the end of the Yuan dynasty 400-ish years later, the clan had grown to several hundred members. One day, a group of bandits attacked the village and killed everyone in the clan. Fortunately, a lady married into the clan with the surname Yu was visiting her parents in another village with her two sons and one nephew. They managed to survive the massacre and went on to become the progenitors of my family's current lineage. The clan continued on, and the village still stands there today. But my family's story in China ended in 1895, when my great-grandfather Yuan Cha and his wife migrated down to Malaysia. At the time, the Fujian province was suffering from a great famine. But opportunity came in the form of the British, who were shipping Chinese coolies into the Southeast Asian region for labor. Yuan Cha and his wife got on a ship and settled down in Malaya, in the state of Negeri Sembilan. My great-grandfather was a successful merchant in the region, and because of their high status, my great-grandmother actually had bounded feet. As they settled down, they had five sons. Their second son was my grandfather, Gong Gong. But their comfortable life came to an end when my great-grandfather's business partner betrayed him, and my great-grandfather died soon afterwards. There's some uncertainty surrounding his death. Some relatives said he committed suicide by drinking poison. Other relatives believed that he was poisoned by his business partner. My Gong Gong was 16 years old when this happened. And so my Gong Gong and his mother packed up and moved down to Banting, where he started to help his mom to sell kueh, which are bite-sized snacks commonly found in Southeast Asia, to earn a living. He also sold toddy, a kind of booze, to the local Indians, where he learned to speak Tamil as a result. On my mom's side of the family, my great-grandfather Liu was an imperial scholar in his village of Meizhou, Guangdong, China. He had taken the Chinese imperial exam and achieved the highest grade in his village. When he married my great-grandmother, she was the daughter of a famous traditional Chinese medicine doctor in Meizhou. My great-grandfather was trained by his father-in-law in TCM. After having three kids in China, my great-grandfather decided to seek better fortunes in Southeast Asia. Sometime during the 1920s, he got on a ship to Malaya. He landed in Seremban, where he ended up being the most highly educated person in the Chinese community there. He started a school and became the local TCM doctor, helping the illiterate to write letters to send back home, conducting marriage ceremonies, burial ceremonies, and etc. He even went on to treat the Yam Tuan of Negeri Sembilan, which is basically the ruler of the state. He helped the Yam Tuan to recover from a severe illness. The Yam Tuan conferred him and his whole family citizenship in Negeri Sembilan, which was quite rare for a Chinese migrant in colonial Malaya. As the Federation of Malaysia was formed after independence, his family was subsequently granted Malaysian citizenship as a result of the history of the Yam Tuan. During World War II, Malaya was under Japanese occupation for a period of 4 years. It was part of Japan's imperial conquest of Asia. My family naturally had its share of war stories. One of the more astonishing stories from wartime was the story of my granduncle, Liu Kuo Fong, my grandmother's oldest brother. With Malaya under occupation, the town of Seremban had ran out of matchsticks. Kuo Fong was invited to join a group to go down to Singapore by train to get supplies of matchsticks back to Seremban. On the way back, the train was stopped by Japanese soldiers. All the other members in my granduncle's group pushed their boxes of matchsticks to him. He ended up getting arrested for smuggling a large amount of matchsticks. He was taken to the Japanese military camp. There, a Japanese officer found out that my granduncle could read English. So he was detained there and given the job of translating English documents left behind the British when they fled Malaya. The Japanese officer was so impressed with my granduncle that many years after the war had ended, my granduncle received a surprised visit from a Japanese businessman who wanted to start a business in Malaysia. He was recommended to find my granduncle by the very same Japanese officer who took him in. Although the Japanese occupation wasn't a huge scar on Malaysian history in comparison to other regions of Asia, it was still a harrowing time. My grandmother, Popo, was alive during that time. To escape the Japanese, my grandmother and her siblings were taken by the neighbors to hide in the jungle. Her mom, my great-grandmother, was about to give birth and had to hide under the bed. She had to put her hands over her baby's mouth to prevent her baby from crying so that the Japanese soldiers can't hear them. My grandmother has lived through many historical events in Malaysia. She was present at the stadium where she listened to Tunku Abdul Rahman, who became our first Prime Minister, announcing the independence of Malaysia from the British on August 31, 1957. That day is celebrated every year since as Hari Merdeka, translating to Freedom Day. She has mentioned regretting not keeping the tiny paper parachutes that fell down to commemorate Independence Day. Since my grandmother was present on the day when Malaysia was born, I frequently like to joke with my family that she is older than Malaysia itself. Growing up, I saw my grandmother as the conservative type. As far as I'm aware, she does not realize that I have tattoos despite the fact that they're fairly prominent on my arms. And she can definitely see them. She hasn't commented on them so far. I digress. For the most part, I see my grandmother as being on the conservative traditional side. But there was a story my mom told me that showed a slightly more radical side to my popo that I wasn't privy to. It was 1969. Malaysia had its third general parliamentary election, where the opposition party made gains at the expense of the ruling coalition, at the time known as the Alliance Party. On May 13, a procession in Kuala Lumpur, which was held by the winning party to celebrate, turned into a racial riot. It spread rapidly throughout the city. Immediately after, a state of emergency was declared and the parliament was suspended. A curfew was ordered throughout the state of Selangor, and eventually the entire country. My grandmother came pretty close to being at the scene, as she was planning on going to the procession, but decided not to at the last minute. At the time, my grandmother was staying in Jinjiang, New Village. Her school had one Malay teacher who was staying in the village with his grandmother. The Chinese villagers were angry after hearing about the racial riots in Kuala Lumpur and wanted to take revenge by killing the Malay teacher. Popo told them that if they did that, the army would come and gun the whole village down. After the villagers had left, Popo and another teacher decided to send the Malay teacher and his grandmother to the nearest police station, where they could get escorted back to their kampong. They took off in a car with the Malay teacher and his grandma hiding in the back seat, and managed to get them to safety to the police station. And that is the end of the highlights reel of my family's history. I hope you've enjoyed my retellings of the family stories I've heard over the years. To the non-Asian listeners, I hope you've gained a new understanding of a part of Asia you might not be aware of. I hope this has piqued an interest in learning more about the lesser-known parts of Asia. To the Asian listeners, I hope you'll find connection in my stories and maybe inspire you to learn more about your histories, if there's a possibility. I know not everyone has the capacity to be connected to their family histories for one reason or another. Knowing your own heritage and family past can help put yourself in context of history, something much bigger than yourself. Thank you for listening to my piece. I hope you enjoy the rest of the Asian Heritage Month programming at CITR. This is Ziwen, signing off. I would like to thank my family for helping me research this piece. Thank you, Mom. Thank you, Papa.
Sick and have contracted COVID-19, the BC Centre for Disease Control recommends staying home from work, school, and away from other public places. If you must go out, avoid using any kind of public transportation, ride-sharing, or taxis. Monitor your symptoms carefully. If your symptoms get worse, call your healthcare provider immediately. Get plenty of rest. Stay hydrated. If you have a medical appointment, call the healthcare provider ahead of time and tell them that you have or may have COVID-19. For medical emergencies, call 911 and notify the dispatch personnel that you have or may have COVID-19. Cover your coughs and sneezes. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds, or clean your hands with an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. As much as possible, stay in a specific room and away from other people in your home. Also, you should use a separate bathroom if available. If you need to be around other people in or outside of the home, always wear a face mask. Avoid sharing personal items with other people in your household, like dishes, towels, and bedding. Make sure all personal items are cleaned with general cleaning products after use. Clean all surfaces that are touched often, like counters, tabletops, and doorknobs. Use household cleaning sprays or wipes according to the label instructions.
Welcome back to Motherlands, the 2020 Asian Heritage Month programming at CITR 101.9 FM. made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Despite the celebration of Asian Heritage Month, we are also in the midst of a global pandemic. Much of the arts and culture programming has been moved online, postponed, or straight up cancelled. The Vancouver Asian Heritage Month Society has been working really hard to adjust, and they've been planning online events and live web panels, which you can find at exploreasian.org. That's exploreasian.org. Adeline Pang, my lovely friend and colleague from CITR, interviews the people at Exploreasian to get the scoop. Let's take a listen.
My name is Leticia Sanchez. I am the president of the Vancouver Asian Heritage Month Society. We are an organization that started in 1996. We are in our 24th year of presenting Asian Heritage Month, celebrating the arts and culture of Asian and Asian Canadian communities. We celebrate also by producing Exploreasian Festival. Our theme for this year was Pan-Asian Cultural Connections. That is how we are celebrating starting on May the 1st.
Great to hear that you guys have been running like for a long time, because this is a very important part of the community. Yeah. So, yeah.
24 years. So next year is going to be huge because we are going to have the 25th anniversary, hopefully together. It depends on how the pandemic and all this crisis that has affected all arts and culture will be. That's what we are planning and that's what we are doing. I will then think to talk about that virtual part, which is a very interesting component of what we do at Asian Heritage.
So first of all, I'm interested to know, why was the word interconnected chosen as the name of the project?
Well, I was trying to write an idea that brought interconnected. One of our main aims is to bring people together, to bring the communities together in this celebration of Asian heritage, and to help people learn more about the communities that live here, Pan-Asian communities living in Vancouver and Metro Vancouver, and at the same time to learn a little bit of history and roots that happened in all these different cultures. And as you know, many people think that when we talk Asia, it's China and probably Japan or Korea, but there are many more Asian communities. So one of the most important parts of calling something interconnected is to find that connection, that networking of all cultures and to learn more about them. For many years, I have been curating all the exhibitions that happen in Asian Heritage. And 3 years ago, I started with a project that was following the Silk Route and beyond in Vancouver, which was a way of connecting the history of each of those Pan-Asian cultures with photographs and connecting them directly to the communities from those cultures living in Metro Vancouver. Interconnected comes as a continuation of that communication among communities and networking, and on interrelating with all of us and the galleries in a way in which we can celebrate Asian heritage and showcase Asian and Canadian artists and artists. So interconnected is a way of networking and continue learning more about the Canadian, Pan-Asian Canadian community.
This is indeed a very valuable community project. So could you give us a summary of the types of art forms that will be exhibited?
Well, I was working towards how many types of art we have. And there are many different ways. We talk about visual arts. We can go from performance to visual art to performances, architecture, conceptual art, art and design, drawings, folk art, sculpture, photographs. Talking about visual arts, it's huge. And the idea with this project is to portray as many art forms as we can with the galleries and the artists that will participate.
So since this is part of the annual Explore Asian Festival, is there anything else that differs from previous exhibitions?
In previous exhibitions, as I said, we brought the artists. We started with artists who were new immigrants and portrayed these new immigrants from different Pan-Asian communities to showcase their art for a day or two. Then the idea was to produce an exhibition and have a venue that will host it for a month. It created a lot of complications because sometimes you have the people to work. And so producing interconnected with the galleries gave us the opportunity to expand a little bit more without the need of presenting an exhibition per se with our own artists. It expands to the opportunity to have more artists showing their art, and even though they are not Asian, mm-hmm. artists who can understand these communities or understand this culture and merge with their own concept of art and project the art of other cultures.
Speaking of incorporating different kinds of artists, like Pan-Asian artists as well as non-Pan-Asian artists, you mentioned in your exhibition brief that this project aims to motivate audiences to appreciate the different styles and similarities of the artwork present while strolling around Metro Vancouver. So the art will feature local scenes then?
It will portray whatever comes to mind from the artist. It doesn't specifically say you have to present only a landmark in Canada. You can present a landmark that represents your culture, or just that idea of showing what you think about culture and heritage. I would say that we have to define two things. Culture as everything that shows how we live, our values, our celebrations, and the arts as a way to express that culture with so many different styles and concepts and mediums. So the idea of interconnected, when I started thinking of that and thinking of a hub and spoke, it was the idea of how can the audience see that what is presented in one gallery, probably coming from an artist from Canada, a Canadian artist, how does it compare, it's not the contrast with other gallery, other artists who's coming, let's say, Indonesia, and how their own concepts merge and express similarities and express that idea of how they understand culture or how they understand the culture of other communities. But to me, it's important that we can put together the people and observe that we are very similar, that with respect and care, we are able to go beyond and to work towards a more accepting society.
So how was the overall experience so far when it comes to coordinating this type of virtual exhibition? Since this year, the exhibition will be online due to the pandemic.
So that's right. So I'm Jane Pallad, and I'm one of the directors from the Vancouver Asian Heritage Month Society. The situation with COVID-19 is definitely something that we have never experienced before. So there are certainly some complexities related to the newness of the situation. And much of it was about how do we reformat and pivot to online. So that was an interesting and really a good problem to solve. And Jasper has helped us with regards to reformatting. So what's working for us is the availability of technology that allows us to come together and publish virtually, as well as the continued enthusiasm of the community around the project. And so we're able to connect with the participating galleries still and artists and explore other means of presenting their works. We certainly felt a sense of eagerness to try new things. So that was very encouraging to move everything online, well, as much as we can. In terms of coordinating it, you and I, we have a problem just getting into a call right now, and that's not unusual. It certainly helps that you see the artwork that is going to be presented, but unfortunately, we have to rely on a lot of digital files. We have to be on top of our emails quite a bit, more than the usual. So it's been very interesting, and it's been a good problem to solve. My background before I moved to Canada included working in the tech sector. So this is not really new to me in terms of connecting with coworkers virtually, but it's not familiar for everyone. So it requires a little bit of, you know, a little bit of education, but also, like I mentioned before, it helps that everyone is eager to try new things. And that certainly helps us in making sure that we're still connecting everyone.
Yeah, that sounds great, since this is a very big shift for you guys to make. So how long will Interconnected be available online?
Right, so what's happened is a lot of different partner galleries and artists have ways of reformatting it. Some have moved their exhibitions online. One of them is Ken Allen. So his exhibition runs from the 27th of April online through his website to the end of May. However, for other exhibitions, like, for example, Glenn Lewis, unfortunately, they're postponing their event. So what I envision for Interconnected Online is we keep these promotional content, these materials, for as long as we're needed to support these partners. So until we get precise information as to when the exhibitions are going to open, we'd like to keep our promotions up and running on the website at the very least.
That's awesome. So the exhibition brief also mentioned that the idea of connecting various galleries and organizations comes from a hub and spoke concept that allows showcasing a larger variety of artworks, art techniques, and mediums. Could you explain a little more about this concept?
Yes, so this is Leticia's brainchild. So Leticia, feel free to...
Oh, it's okay. Go ahead. I think that the concept of hub and spoke is very well known in museums, and especially with the Chinese Canadian Museum. We were talking about that idea of hub and spoke. I think that my point of view would be that we can reach to more audiences when we have hubs and spokes. We have more elements that can be used to give a better understanding of what we're trying to transmit. In the case of Interconnected, I will leave Jing to continue with it, because I think that the concept is very well known in the arts and culture. Specifically for exploration, it means that we can reach to more people and more artists and connect, but I will let her continue with that.
Yeah, so Leticia is explain that quite a bit, but just more specifically, the hub and spoke model, at least how Leticia initially envisioned it for Interconnected, was originally it was conceptualized to have a singular event that will launch this project to the public, and then the public will go to these exhibitions during the course of the entire month. The plan was for the public to have access to multiple participating exhibitions, where a variety of artists will present a broad range of practices. Some will have presented paintings, others videos, others sound. So the idea was to spread traffic throughout the city of Vancouver into these art spaces for the purpose of exploring Pan-Asian culture.
So now with this virtual format, is there a way for visitors to provide feedback on the exhibits just like they would in a guest book in museums?
Well, yeah, that's a really interesting question, because you're marrying the actual experience of going to an exhibition and also how it translates virtually. So for the project itself, our website is equipped with a contact us page. Our social media is also very active at the moment, and it's going well, and we welcome feedback through those channels. The participating galleries, artists that we're promoting, they also have their own online channels, and what we do is to make sure that the public has access to that by making them aware that those channels exist for any questions about their work.
So yeah, it would be very interesting to check out the different exhibitions once all the artists, like all the works become available on the site. I hope people will enjoy this new format. And so, yeah, I thank you for taking the time to chat with me today. And yeah, best of luck on all your work so far.
Thank you so much. And, I would like to invite people who you reach to check our website, to check what we're doing. We are expecting that this virtual exploration will take us to the next level. And probably Interconnected will continue next year. Hopefully with more artists, hopefully with both combining virtual and real time. Mm-hmm. And the idea is celebrating with many languages, many people, and one celebration, Asian Heritage Month. So thank you for giving us a time and a space, and the invitation to follow us.
The Virtual Interconnected Project will be up from the 1st of May onwards. Just visit exploration.org/interconnectedproject. Here, we will be featuring art exhibitions and works of art from participating galleries and artists.
This is Motherlands on CITR 101.9 FM, made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. For the month of May, I will be watching / recommending some media by Asian creators. I watched the half of it directed by Alice Wu a few days ago, and it's a film that really accurately depicts the way Asian parents express their love through actions. That and grappling with the realization that you've fallen in love with a girl. So it's really nice. Pretty like lighthearted, and with everything that's going on in the world right now, it's nice to have something that's just pure, you know? So yeah, today's producers of Motherland's first episode, Histories, were Ziwen Tu, Adeline Peng, and I. If you have a story you want to tell, if you want to make something for Asian History Month, or if you're an Asian SoundCloud rapper, shoot me an email at specialprogramming@citr.ca. Tune in at the same time next Tuesday, May 12th at 3 p.m. for episode 2 of Motherlands. Next week's theme is Sounds from Home and will be quite fun and experimental, so you definitely don't want to miss out. I'm your host, Aiza. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.